Okay, let's go on to part two here. So again, this will air at a completely different time. This will be a somewhat shorter interview, and talking specifically about morality and aggression and sex and good stuff like that. So
okay.
Well, I want to start with the story that you tell in your book about the—I don't know if I'm saying this right—the Chippewyan people of northern Manitoba.
Ah, yes, yes.
And there's a sort of a startling story that you tell. Can you tell us that story?
Yes, the story comes from a novel written by, what's his name? Joe Bowden, called The Three-Day Road. And in the story, one of the events that happens is that, not uncommonly in the north when the winters are very harsh and the Aboriginal people like the Chippewa and the Cree and so forth had to struggle to survive through the winter. And sometimes they would be lucky and there would be game, and other times they would starve. And the weak, of course, were the ones who would die. In the story of the three-day road, what happens is that the game is very low. People are on the verge of starvation. The woman who has recently had a child finds that her milk is drying up. And one night, she and her husband leave the camp and wander off through the birch trees elsewhere. She comes back alone in the spring with the baby, and the baby is very strong and healthy. Indeed, to be wondered at, given the nature of the harsh, harsh winter. Well, it's obvious to everyone in the camp, with the husband gone and the baby and the wife looking so healthy and well-fed, it's obvious to them what has happened. And because cannibalism is really frowned upon for generations upon generations and well-recognized not to be acceptable, it comes to pass that she is rather shunned, and she sort of recognizes what ultimately must happen. And eventually, the chief of that particular group kills her by suffocation and then also kills the baby. And for those of us who live in real luxury and are well fed every day and never have to worry about starvation in the winter, this story can seem terribly cruel. But it needs to be put in the context of the ecology that the people had to suffer, and the fact that over many, many generations, it was very important that cannibalism not be acceptable. And it was also clear that if the baby was saved, it would always be tainted by the story that it had fed on its father's flesh.
Because, I mean, now, that's one of the questions that comes from the story. I mean, this haunting, sad story that, okay, maybe, I mean, you certainly could justify what the mother did, but on the other hand, it's sort of horrific. But the baby, why did the baby have to die?
Why did the baby have to die? And as I said, I think within the culture, it was felt that he would always be tainted, wrongly perhaps. But remember, these are small groups of, 50 to 70 people. Everyone would know, and it would inevitably be passed on to the children and their children. Everyone would know, and he would never be treated the same, and he might himself grow up to be very corrupt. That was the fear. And it may well have been rooted in fact of some kind generations earlier, where the story would be passed on and passed on. But the point that I kind of wanted to draw from this story, because it really did sear me, was that it's very easy to feel confident in the rightness of the moral practices of your own group, and very easy to criticize those practices of a different group, and that we have to not be foolish about accepting any practices as good as any other, but we also have to be very judicious about recognizing the role of environment and ecology in certain practices coming into existence, certain moral practices into existence.
If we step back for a moment and talk about the history of morality, the deep history, do we know? Can we speculate about how humans came to have moral values?
Oh, what a wonderful question. Yes, yes, we can. Up to a point. So there's kind of two things that I like to think about in wondering about the origin of moral values. One is the continuity between all mammals with regard to care of others, specifically with regard to care of offspring, and then depending on the mammalian species, not only care of offspring, but care of mates, care of others in the group, care of kin. And we don't really see anything comparable in turtles or lizards. We do in birds.
So, which is interesting. I mean, so the point is that a mammal, a mammalian mother, will care for its offspring. A turtle mother just lays its eggs, and that's it. I mean, those offspring are on their own.
They're on their own. And so the interesting question is, what happened in mammalian brains that brought about this shift from self-care, seeing to my own safety, warmth, and food, to extending that to others who are kind of like me, but not exactly me? And the basic answer is that because mammalian offspring are born so dependent, which is an advantage in the long run because those dependent brains are immature and they can tune themselves up to local environments. So the dependency is an advantage, but unless it's backed by something, namely care by the parent, it all goes for naught. So dependency and immaturity are kind of locked together in this story.
But to make this work, there have to be reasons why the mother is willing to care for its offspring. I mean, it's a lot of work.
It's dangerous,
exactly.
And oftentimes it's a cost to herself. I mean, she could be out having fun. And the answer is that there is circuitry in subcortical structures, in these very ancient structures in the hypothalamus, that essentially see to it that the mother cares for the offspring, and she feels pain when she doesn't, and she feels pleasure when she does.
What gives her pleasure when she's caring for her baby?
When the babies are close to her, that's pleasurable. If they fall out of the nest or if they are threatened by a predator, that's very painful to her. But interestingly also, and this ultimately relates to language, that another invention came along, and that is infants would squeal if they were cold or if they were hungry. And mothers feel pain when the infants squeal, and they do whatever is necessary to stop it. They will feed them, they will suckle them, they will bring them close to the body and warm them up and so forth. So vocalization by mammals, and we see this also, of course, in birds, vocalization in mammals really begins with the importance of infants causing pain to the mother so that the mother will ensure that they are cared for.
And aren't there certain chemicals that are triggered to elicit these responses from the mother? I mean, for instance, we've heard of oxytocin as a key chemical that seems to nurture this mothering instinct.
Oxytocin is a very ancient peptide. It's a rather simple neurochemical, but in mammals, you are absolutely right, it's put to new use. And an important part of the use is that it causes the mother and the infant to be very bonded to each other so that they want to be together, they dislike being separated, they want to see to the welfare of the other one and so forth. So oxytocin is kind of the hub of the story, but I really kind of want to emphasize hub because there are many other neurochemicals that have to be part of the story, including female chemicals like estrogen. But oxytocin is also found in males, and we know that from recent work of Kelly Lambert, that males exposed to a pup, even if it's not their own pup, you will see a surge of oxytocin in the brain. Mm-hmm. And vasopressin is the other one. It's sort of a sibling neurochemical to oxytocin. And we're not exactly sure what the roles of either of these things is, but what the roles are, rather. But in the case of vasopressin, we do know that it's important for protection against predators. So it seems to play some role in aggression. But there's much that remains to be understood on that.
So how do we go from caring for members of our family, our children, for instance, to caring about our community and upholding the values that we cherish so much, honesty, loyalty, courage? How do we explain that from a brain perspective?
Well, I think that the answer is still rather tentative, but the approach that I favor goes rather like this, that, of course, different species will have different degrees of attachment to others within the group. And so we can see, for example, that in baboons, the females of one matriline, the mother and her daughters and her daughters, are all very attached to each other. So that's going to be part of the story. But I think that the other part of the story goes like this. That one of the things about oxytocin seems to be that when oxytocin levels go up, then stress hormones decline. And it's what Sue Carter calls a kind of safety signal. So that you come into my camp, I don't know, are you okay? Are you weird? Are you going to cause me trouble? And then you make some gesture, you bow or you give me something, I relax. And then you and I may be able to cooperate on something. We may be able to cooperate on building a boat or on achieving some end that's of interest to both of us. So I think cooperation can emerge. And once cooperation emerges, then I see the benefits of having you in the group and having you as a cooperator. So I think there's a kind of wonderful, not vicious, but virtuous circle here, so that oxytocin kind of sets the stage where we can begin to do things together and to get on. And once that happens, other kinds of problem solving come into play so that we begin to see that deception is not tolerable in the group, as, for example, in the case of the Inuit. For them, deception was a far worse offense than, say, murder, because it imperiled the group as a whole. Hmm. And so we see that certain kinds of practices are good for the group as a whole. Others are bad for the group as a whole. And so these virtues of truth-telling, promise-keeping, loyalty, and so forth, I think, begin to emerge. And we can see these in slightly less sophisticated form in other primates, in monkeys and in baboons and in chimpanzees and bonobos.
Well, if we're going to talk about morality, we also have to talk about the other side of it, which is aggression, violence. How does that fit into this whole moral discussion? Because it would seem that most aggression would run counter to moral instincts.
Now, aggression, I think, is very complicated. I think in a certain way it's much, much more ancient than cooperative and moral behavior, because aggression is needed by, well, certainly all mammals to protect the young and to protect others in the group from attacks. But it's, of course, needed long before mammals were on the scene by predators. So I think that aggression is always going to be a part of predation. Now, part of what kind of is surprising in this story is this, that you think about predation. I mean, think about it in the case of a mammal, and suppose that what you are is a leopard and you or a wolf, let's say, and you're trying to bring down a caribou with your pals. It's a very dangerous thing. You're always in danger of being clubbed by a foot, or horned, and you have to be up for it. And my view is that predation involves energy, high levels of energy, and as Jaak Panksepp, a neuroscientist, is fond of saying, energy involves pleasure. And so the thought is that aggression, by and large, has a component of pleasure.
Of joy, and actually, I suppose.
Of joy.
There's something thrilling about being aggressive.
Absolutely. And, of course, if you lose, it's bad, but if you win, the feeling of exaltation and of wonderfulness has got to be really quite extreme. So I think this is true of predation in hominins, as they were almost certainly involved in trying to take down large mammals or even small mammals. I mean, even killing a rabbit, you know, that requires some gumption. You can't just sort of say, well, die, little thing, die. You actually have to get it right in there and kill it. So that made me kind of look at aggression in general between humans in a slightly different way. And I began to look at aggression, for example, in the case of cage fighting. Why do men want to do that? And I tell the story in the book of Jonathan Gottschalk, who's this wonderful literary scholar, who we were in a taxi ride once away from a meeting, and he said, you know, I like to cage fight. Jonathan, how is this possible?
Wait, he likes to do it himself, not just watch it?
He likes to do it himself. And I said, so what is it about cage fighting? He said, it's exciting and it is pleasurable. And he said that what cage fighters say is that, of course, to lose is terrible. But he said, if you win, it's better than sex. Well, I mean, that's not something I could really speak to, not ever having engaged in cage fighting. But, I mean, it must be pleasurable. Otherwise, why would soccer hooligans go out every Saturday and break heads and have themselves a whale of a time?
Well, let me follow up on that, because, I mean, one thing that's striking is we know that men are far more likely to get involved in these kinds of fights than women
are.
And we know that from, you know, crime reports, whatever. Why? I mean, what is it about the male brain that seems to be so different from the female brain in terms of sort of sparking this level of aggression?
It's not understood. I think there are lots of people who are ready to toss out a simple story about testosterone. But, you know, the testosterone story and all this crap about testosterone poisoning and so forth, it's a very, very complicated story, because it isn't just high levels of testosterone that are associated with aggression. It depends on whether the testosterone levels are high and whether stress hormones are high. And so someone who has very low stress hormones but high testosterone is not particularly aggressive. So, and then there are other factors that are involved as well, such as serotonin, and it plays a role. So if, depending on serotonin levels, along with these other things like stress hormones and testosterone, you may get certain kinds of aggression or you may not. So it's a very complicated story, and I really kind of want to resist the idea that there's something simple about it. But having said that, of course, you're absolutely right that it is much more a male thing than a female thing. Having said that, though, notice that in almost all species, the female can be absolutely ferocious in the defense of the young.
Mm-hmm. But is there something then about the female brain that just is wired differently so that it
won't? Oh, I think it has to be. Sure. I think it has to be. Now, what that difference is, I think we haven't really understood at this point. And it's going to be complicated because it will involve other hormones. We know that the brain is masculinized by testosterone secreted by the testes at the beginning of, I think it's the second month of gestation. And that unless the brain is masculinized, the brain will be a female brain. So we know that there are differences, and that mainly they pertain to subcortical structures, for example, in the hypothalamus. And so that women tend to find ways of avoiding within-group aggression, or they do it in ways that don't involve physical violence. So, I mean, women can be very aggressive when it comes to things like gossip and shunning, but they don't particularly like to engage in physical attack. Now, that's got to be something that we can address neurobiologically, but it's not something that we currently understand.
So to sort of try to put all of this in context, talking about morality and what the brain can reveal about our moral instincts, what would you say are the big mysteries out there still? What is it that we still don't understand about the origins of morality?
Well, I think we do understand the basic platform, and the basic platform is this bonding and attachment that we see emerge with the mammalian brain, and that provides the platform. But then what we don't understand, I think, is the nature of that circuitry in great detail, or the kinds of changes that underlie very different sorts of social arrangements, for example, between wolves on the one hand and baboons on the other, and humans different yet again. And bear in mind, too, that human morality is very, very sophisticated, and that part of the story is that humans have this great, huge, fat cortex, and it gives us a huge amount of flexibility. Now, rats have more flexibility than we used to think, but they don't have the flexibility for acquiring certain kinds of practices and so forth that humans do. And so humans can live in the most remarkably different kinds of social and ecological conditions. I think one of the sort of pressing questions is going to be how, in a globalized world, we can get on in such a way that that we all manage, and that we don't have wars where there is massive amounts of killing. And that's something, you know, that Steve Pinker has addressed. But I mean, it's an issue that a number of people, of course, are very concerned about.
Well, you have left us wanting to know more. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was fun. That was great.
Oh, good. Oh, good. Thank you. Yes. Yes, you led me along very, very helpfully. I'm never quite sure, you know, how much stuff to put in. And you really did that wonderfully. So I want to say how much I appreciate it.
Well, you gave us so much to talk about. So anyway, thank you. This has been a pleasure. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No,
it was eating
flesh.
The father's flesh because the mother and the baby came back.
Yeah, you see, father. Yeah, yeah. Sorry, the father didn't come back. So presumably, I hope this was clear from what I said. Presumably, the father shot himself.
Yeah.
And then because it was cold, they were able to keep the meat from decaying, and they were able to eat, or at least she was able to eat and feed the baby, and ultimately the baby was able to eat as well. And so they came back healthy. Yeah, I know that is an amazing book, actually, The 3-Day Road. It's a wonderful book.
Anyway, thank you so much. This was a real pleasure. Okay.
No, it's great to be here. Thanks again.
Okay, sure.
Bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.